it is tough living. When we were there, first there was a snowstorm, then there was a sandstorm.
Senator Begich visits Alaska troops in Afghanistan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 16th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. And the Copper Basin 300 is canceled mid-race due to bitter cold and challenging snow conditions.
It was about waist deep, and they were basically just wallowing in it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Providence Health and Services Alaska and North Rim Bank.
Organizers of a citizens' ballot initiative to restore Alaska's coastal management program have well over the number of signatures required to put it on the statewide ballot, says Juneau Mayor Bruce Botello.
We've exceeded 30,000, and in terms of overall numbers, it's approaching my level of comfort.
Volunteers started gathering signatures less than a month ago. 26,000 are required. The signatures must be filed with the State Division of Elections tomorrow. Botello says volunteers will stop the petition drive at 6 p.m. The question now is whether they have the required district distribution, which is
7% of registered voters have voted in the last election in each of 30 of 40 House districts.
Botello and Kodiak Island Borough Mayor Jerome Selby are among several local officials who formed the Alaska Sea Party to bring back a coastal management program. The Parnell administration shut down the program last summer after the legislature and governor's office failed to reach a compromise to renew it. Sea Party organizers will hold a news conference tomorrow to update the initiative's progress. If the legislature enacts substantially similar legislation this session, the initiative would not appear on the statewide ballot this fall. Juneau Representative Beth Kurtula believes the legislature will take it up. She says collecting more than 26,000 signatures in record time is a powerful message.
Legislators will sit up and take notice that, you know, the state's pretty much spoken on it and we need to get back to work and get our program back. We lost it by one vote last session, and now we're the only coastal state in the union not to have a coastal zone program.
Alaska has nearly 40% of the entire coastline of the United States and has no program to coordinate management. Alaska Senator Mark Begich says his confidence in the possible success of the war in Afghanistan is higher after a brief, intense trip to the country. Begich spoke with reporters today after returning. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Senator Begich spent 2.5 days visiting Alaska-based troops and meeting with officials such as the U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He visited places including Kabul, Camp Bastion in the Helmand province, and Kandahar. It was the Democratic senator's second time in Afghanistan. The first was nearly 3 years ago in the spring of 2009.
Today, based on what I saw and what I heard, it is much better. And, you know, the challenge is, you know, we have a Taliban that is hell-bent on trying to take back the government through force. And what's clearly happening, a transition of time since I've been there, now my second trip, is that the Afghanis are getting fed up with the Taliban.
Senator Begich says he saw more leadership and initiative from Afghan troops on this visit rather than dependence on the American and international forces. He says he still expects challenges after President Obama's planned withdrawal of combat troops in 2014. Begich says security is the key so the Afghan people can do basic commerce, attend school, and run the government, but he says it's still a dangerous place.
Matter of fact, one of the governors that we were going to see in the southwestern district was killed the day before we got there. He was on our schedule to meet with. He was, again, one of our better allies. And what happens now is the Taliban picks out high target folks of that nature to put fear into the communities versus in the past, they would do lots of activities.
Begich participated in award ceremonies for Fairbanks-based soldiers with the 125 Stryker Brigade Combat Team, including pinning combat action badges on Sergeant Ricardo Tucker and Sergeant Eva Haney. The senator says he heard from soldiers that they do have the basic supplies they need, but he says they're hardly living in luxury.
It is tough living. When we were there, first there was a snowstorm. Then there was a sandstorm, then there were high wind storm, within a 2.5-day period. And it was unbelievable conditions and from just that environment you live in.
Last month, 8 soldiers with the Fairbanks-based Stryker Brigade were charged with crimes, including involuntary manslaughter and negligent homicide in the death of 19-year-old Private Danny Chen. The soldier killed himself in October after what his family alleges was harassment and hazing by his comrades.
That is a very sad situation that occurred, and there's no question that the military, from what I heard in our brief conversations on this, because it is a criminal investigation, we limit our discussions as they move through the process, but I will say that it's clear they are going to prosecute at the highest level in ensuring that there is justice for the family. So I feel very confident that's going to occur.
Tensions in Afghanistan have flared in recent days after a video surfaced of American Marines in combat gear urinating on the bodies of 3 Taliban fighters. Begich says the men, who were not Alaskans, should be dealt with harshly. He says in his 2.5 days on the ground, he didn't witness fallout stemming from the video.
But oddly enough, there was very little discussion. And here's why I think the Afghanis, from what we picked up there, knew this was not the norm. This was a very unique situation. It was not the norm for any of their U.S. troops or allies that are on the ground there.
Begich went to Afghanistan with 2 other members of Congress, fellow Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon and Republican Representative Wayne Huizinga of Michigan. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The State Board of Game has approved aerial wolf hunting on the Kenai Peninsula for the first time. The board unanimously passed 2 proposals today to implement the Predator Control Plan in Game Management Units 15A and 15C on the northern and southern peninsula. Both plans call for reducing wolf populations to increase moose hunting opportunities. Board member Ted Spraker said during discussion that the board couldn't let the moose populations decline any further.
I think it's well worth the try, because if we're able to adopt a plan that removes at least some of the impact that's caused by wolves on our moose population, I think what it'll do is it'll buy us some time.
Spraker said this year's intense winter snowfall is likely to increase both calf and adult moose mortality on the Kenai, but critics of the plan are adamant that predator control is not the way to boost moose populations. John Toppenberg is executive director of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance.
Our concern is that basically what we have is a habitat issue down there. It's been characterized as a predator pit, which it in no way is. The habitat has been degraded because of lack of fires on the peninsula, and in the lower section of the peninsula, Area 15C, actually the moose population down there is growing. There are major problems with overpopulation of rabbits brought on by too few wolves and too few lynx.
The Board of Game continues deliberations on game management issues through Wednesday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Holly Brooks takes a break from World Cup competition to try to heal from a painful injury.
You know, you don't really want to have any physical decrement when you're trying to race the World Cup.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
The Russian tanker Renda is pumping fuel. After a 5,000-mile journey across the Pacific and breaking through 400 miles of ice to Nome, the Renda began to transfer its payload of 1.3 million gallons of gas and diesel just before 4:30 this afternoon. The fuel's running through 2,000 feet of hoses across the sea ice into the port's headers and up to Sitnasok's tank farm. Vitus Marine CEO Mark Smith says there will be around-the-clock watches aboard the Renda and on the ice.
Bonanza has kindly arranged for a 24-hour hose watch. We'll have folks monitoring the transfer hoses every 30 minutes. And, of course, there'll be folks at the City of Nome's header, and there'll also be folks at Bonanza. And there's enough staffing to operate all these positions 24 hours a day.
Sitnasok Board Chair Jason Evans says the plan is to systematically empty the Renda's payload using the tanker's powerful pumps.
Once they've pumped the fuel off the ship on each container, they clear the hose with a blast of air, pumping it back from shore to the ship to make sure the line's clear, and then they disconnect and unload the next tank.
The commander for the Coast Guard in Alaska, Rear Admiral Thomas Osterbo, was in Nome yesterday. He says the mission for the Coast Guard is at a critical stage.
Our goal is, and I made it crystal clear to my folks and everybody involved, that nobody gets hurt, no product gets spilled, we don't have any accidents, and it's not over until Renda's back out of the ice and heading back to Russia, and Healy's safely back in Seattle, and all the product is safely up in the fuel farm.
Joining the admiral were Senator Lisa Murkowski, Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, and several state commissioners who flew in with a plane load of reporters. Senator Murkowski said the historic fuel delivery points to America's needs in the Arctic.
It's not just Nome that is an Arctic community. It's not just Alaska that is an Arctic state. We are an Arctic nation. And in order to move around in an Arctic nation, we might need some ice-breaking capacity. And the Healy has demonstrated exactly what that means to a community of 3,500 people and the region.
Lieutenant Governor Treadwell also called for an increased Coast Guard presence in the Arctic.
The nation does need heavy polar-class icebreakers because the Arctic Ocean is becoming much more accessible. Shipping is becoming much more widespread, and we have to have the Coast Guard mission here fully prepared.
The Healy is the Coast Guard's only functioning icebreaker and is designed for research. Organizers of the Copper Basin 300 canceled the sled dog race on Sunday, less than halfway through the course, after mushers encountered extreme cold and an impassable stretch of trail. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Copper Basin 300 is a qualifier race for both the Iditarod and Yukon Quest, and it has a reputation for challenging mushers. Race organizers call it the toughest 300 miles in Alaska, and it lived up to that reputation this year due to recent heavy snows and bitter cold over the weekend, around 50 below throughout much of the race. Race Marshal Greg Parvin confirmed Sunday night that organizers had to call off the race and will refund most of the mushers' entry fees.
$300 of $400 will be returned to each musher.
Eileen Mars, the handler for her musher son, Wade Mars, said Sunday it was about 12 miles on the other side of Myers Lake, on the leg to Sourdough, that mushers ran into a bad stretch of what they call sugar snow.
It was about waist deep, and they were basically just wallowing in it. And the teams that left here that continued on towards Sourdough ran into basically a mountain of that.
Eileen Mars says it didn't take long before mushers began trading the lead positions to take turns on breaking trail before finally deciding it just wasn't worth it.
They all pretty much piled up in one spot, and then there were a couple, I think John Schandelmeyer and somebody else checked the trail out and said there's no way that anybody's going to continue farther without having issues.
We caught up with Mars at the Myers Lake Roadhouse, where organizers decided to end the race. She was holed up there while waiting to bring two dog teams back to their home in Kinnick. Mars says she got a sense of how bad it was out there after talking with some of the mushers and others who'd helped prepare the course as they were returning to the roadhouse.
And I talked to the National Guardsmen that broke the trail on snow machines, and they wallowed around in it from 8 o'clock yesterday morning until they'd been out there for, I think they said, 26 hours total.
Alan Moore of Two Rivers was setting a hot pace early on in the race. He made the run from Chistochina to Paxson in 6 hours and 20 minutes, with defending race champion Jake Berkowitz of Big Lake 7 minutes behind. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Anchorage's animal control facility is coping with rescue dogs and cats, even parakeets, from two animal cruelty cases. Brooke Taylor is the facility's spokesperson.
Well, it's a lot of animals for us to intake on any particular day, even for a week possibly, depending on the time of year. So it has placed quite a burden on our shelter resources. The actual numbers were 39 dogs and around 40 parakeets from one case and 22 cats from a separate case.
Two Eagle River men arrested Saturday have been charged with two counts of animal cruelty. 50-year-old Daniel Hoffman and 46-year-old Lester Mendez were brought to the attention of the police when a maintenance man entered their rental property and found kennels stacked to the ceiling. There were also multiple cages of parakeets in the home, according to APD spokesperson Anita Schell.
There may be more charges. That would be a decision for the prosecutor, but that Department of Public Health responded, and after they looked at the house, they deemed it uninhabitable. So, you know, I don't know if this was a hoarding situation or if they were pets or if they, I just don't have the answer to that. But they did say that they allowed the dogs to go to the bathroom inside of the house because it was too cold outside.
Shell says there was no heat in the house that same day. A second case of cruelty involving 22 cats was discovered. Animal Control's Taylor says the city shelter is asking for help with supplies.
We have a list of supplies that we're requesting if people would like to support our activities right now that they donate. The first would be non-clumping cat litter, parakeet food, small clean blankets and towels, canned dog and cat food, and science diet dry food dog food for small breed.
Taylor says she's not able to comment on the details of the case pending a police investigation. She says staff veterinarians are working with the animals to determine their health.
We're not considering euthanasia for any of the animals right now. Currently, right now, the animals are looking in fair to good condition. Everybody is settling in well, so at this point in time, we're not anticipating having to do that.
She says the legal aspects of the case prevent the dogs, cats, and parakeets involved from being adopted at this time.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. Good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Providence Health and Services Alaska and North Rim Bank.
With fewer than 150 known fluent speakers, the Aleutic language is just one of many indigenous languages worldwide that are in danger of extinction. However, with the concerted efforts from people like April Counselor, that won't happen. Counselor is the language manager at the Aleutic Museum and the activity director for a new Aleutic Studies program at the Kodiak College. Last week, the museum was awarded a $40,000 grant to complete a book on the orthography of the Kodiak subdialect of the Aleutic language, for which only 45 known fluent speakers remain. Counselor says the project comes at a key stage after many years of creating language materials and developing speakers.
We now have this group of intermediate fluent speakers that needs this. This isn't something that we would have needed 5 years ago because we didn't have anyone that would have used it. But now we're getting to the point where we do have those intermediate speakers that are not fully fluent, but they're getting there. And I think that's why this is so important.
Counselor says the idea for the book came as a result of her work on a similar book for the Chugach dialect of the language, which is spoken in Prince William Sound and on the Kenai Peninsula.
We thought, well, it would be such an easy jump once that manuscript is created to create the Kodiak version.
Counselor says Dr. Jeff Lear, an early researcher of the language, was integral to establishing Aleutic as a written language in the late 70s. Lear, who is now in retirement, will be a major contributor to the book, which seeks to standardize the Aleutic writing system. The book will also be used in the newly established Aleutic Studies program at the Kodiak College. The second of the two finalists hoping to succeed retiring Carol Como for the Anchorage School District superintendent position spent 3 days interviewing and visiting the city last week. During that time, Stephen Atwater met with the local press. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Atwater is the current superintendent of the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. Before that, he served as superintendent of the Lake and Peninsula School District. His first Alaska position was as a secondary teacher in Amonik. His career contrasts with the other finalist, Jim Browder, who spent last week here in Anchorage. Browder's over 3 decades of educational experience is entirely in Florida. Another difference? Browder is the former superintendent of the Lee County School District, the 40th largest in the nation with approximately 82,000 students. Atwater's Kenai Peninsula District consists of 44 schools and about 9,000 students. Anchorage has approximately 49,000 students.
I know it's one of the main ones that people are concerned about, that I don't have the oomph or whatever to do this job.
However, Atwater sees a move to Alaska's largest school district as part of a familiar pattern.
When I went from Lake and Peninsula to Kenai, Kenai is 25 times bigger than Lake and Penn. Now the step to Anchorage is 5 times bigger. I'm confident I can make that step. And I'm also confident that there's a infrastructure in here to support that transition from when I get here, that this district is not in disarray, it's in good shape, and that the transition in would be done well.
In his application, Atwater says his beginnings with the smaller $13 million budget of the Lake and Peninsula District forced him into an intimate knowledge of a school district's financial management. The Kenai Peninsula District budget is $152 million. Atwater adds that no matter what the size, he's already familiar with the state's funding process and the specifics of local contributions. While he has worked with Alaska Native students who have had language challenges, he acknowledges he does not have experience with immigrant populations whose children have little or no English skills. The Anchorage School District lists over 90 primary languages other than English among its students. When asked how he'd like to improve Anchorage schools, 2 elements stood out. The big one, he said, is there's not enough instructional tightness.
The district could stand to be more tightly coupled with regard to instruction. I think it's overly site-dependent. I think that would benefit from sites having a tighter alignment with regard to instruction than they do currently. And I think that once that's in place, that the schools will benefit from one another and be able to collaborate at a greater level than they currently do.
Atwood's second target is classroom technology. Again, he would seek more uniformity.
I think there's too much autonomy at the school level to purchase technology to do their own thing. For instance, at one of the high schools, I heard there's 6 different computer images that are out there. It should be standardized down to 1 or 2 so that a technology can be blasted out and to re-image a computer instead of worrying about which computer has a different image. Those are some of the basic things that you can do, I think, to eliminate the inefficiencies.
Atwater said he found many strengths within the district. He particularly praised the Anchorage School District's adoption of the Response to Instruction program and how it had broadened RTI beyond the original concept of selective student intervention to all students. He said that was a step beyond the Kenai District's approach when it began the program a few years ago. The Anchorage School Board's timetable calls for a decision between Atwater and Browder by month's end, followed by a transition period with the new superintendent officially assuming the position on July 1st. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Anchorage skier Keegan Randall picked two more Silver World Cup medals in Milan, Italy. On Sunday, she placed second in the individual sprint, and on Sunday, she repeated that performance in the team sprint. She's still the number one female sprinter in the world and in fourth place on the World Cup overall. Meanwhile, her APU teammate Holly Brooks is taking a three-week break from the World Cup tour. Brooks is spending the time in Italy and Austria recuperating from a broken wrist. With some good rest, she is hopeful she can heal enough to race again next month with a goal of making the U.S. ski team next season. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
Early on, Holly Brooks was having a breakthrough season on the World Cup Tour. She had only intended to race in Europe through mid-December, but her results were so strong she was invited to stay and race through the remainder of the season. But on Christmas Day in Italy, she encountered some bad luck.
I went on a run on an icy road right before Christmas dinner and slipped on the ice and caught myself with my hand. I knew right away that something was wrong for sure.
Brooks had fractured the bone at the end of her forearm. Most people would put it in a cast for 6 weeks. But Brooks raced through the grueling 9-event Tour de Ski. She says it was painful but tolerable.
In the day-to-day movement, it's not that bad. But I'm really looking forward to a period where I don't have to put a lot of stress on the bones. And, you know, you don't really want to have any physical decrement when you're trying to race the World Cup. And so I'm really trying to heal it up and get back to the races.
Brooks has a custom-made cast that even allows her to swim. She'll still train during this break from racing, but will protect her wrist. She hopes to get back to World Cup competition in early February in Rybinsk, Russia. If she skis strong the rest of the season, Brooks is hopeful she'll be named to the U.S. ski team next year. She says it's been an exciting winter.
You know, I've raced in 6 countries since departing Anchorage in November, and a chance to test my fitness against the best in the world and see some of the most beautiful places in the world at the same time. And so all in all, it's been really rewarding, and I've been really happy with it, despite the injury.
It hasn't been cheap, though. Brooks is paying her own way on the World Cup with help from friends, family, and her old ski clubs in Washington State. She says it's costing around $20,000. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Ben Matheson and Matthew Smith in Nome, Tim Ellis in Delta, Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick. So quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.